today is my special honor and pleasure to have Daniel Gutenberg on the Making It Real podcast. Daniel is one of the most successful unicorn hunters that I know in Europe. He has, for example, invested in companies like Netscape, Intershop, Facebook, Airbnb, Zynga, Mobileye, and many more. Has to tell us how many he has hunted so far and the ones that he's looking for. And very excitingly as well, Daniel started, I know, as a surfer in Hawaii somehow, and then became an entrepreneur, to then became an investor. So I think we have fascinating learnings here from all these different perspectives. But I think the best is if Daniel, if you could just tell us, what was your journey to make it real? What was your first steps into the entrepreneurship world?
So I started very young as a kid already, selling kits. Electronic kits to make illegal radio stations when I was probably around 15. And my second entrepreneurial run was making clubs, discotheques, and so organizing DJs and music and the whole party thing when I was about 18. And then I kept on trying stuff, and I was selling fax machines for a while before they were legal in Switzerland. But I really, after my stay in the US, being a surf instructor and a ski teacher, when I came back to Switzerland, I worked for a company for a year and then started my own company. Doing network services and bringing products into Europe, mostly from the States, portable hard disks, and then later on the whole internet stuff, Netscape, Alta Vista, Oracle, and all these products that I was distributing and selling to dealers in several countries in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Was that always that you wanted to be an entrepreneur? So when you worked for this one first company, right, where you said, like, I don't really want to work like that. I want to be independent. Or did it just happen like that?
Well, on one hand, my father was already an entrepreneur, so I kind of saw what's going on at home. And on the other hand, I only had one serious job, if I don't count the windsurfing position as a serious job. And when this one was over, I was made redundant because the company was merged with another company that already had the position I was having as a technical director. So it just didn't happen that I had another job lined up. So I started to work and do a little money here and a little money there, and started to hire one and two and three people, and then decided to write a business plan and to really do it. So it kind of was an accident.
Uh-huh. So kind of like, what should I do starting out? How did you decide to which products to actually import? Or did that process as well evolve, how you decided this?
Yeah, that was total luck. I mean, I was doing services, networking services for companies. I was pretty good at computer networks, and I needed a set of tools when I went to visit the companies. So I needed a portable hard disk that I could connect to the networks of my clients. And I imported this portable hard disk from the US, and every time I was at the client's place, they like, wow, this is pretty cool. We also need one. So I started to import these portable hard disks, and it started to be a really good business. I was selling those hard disks to resellers and also to distributors, and it was a really good business until the day when this manufacturer went bankrupt. From one day to the next, I already had a few employees. I was doing the marketing. I was doing the support. I translated all the manuals, and from one day to the next, I couldn't get any hard disks anymore. In my mind, I was doing, you know, 1 or 2 or 3% of his turnover, because I thought it's just Switzerland, it's so small. It can't be much more than that. And so when he went bankrupt, I flew over to the States to meet him for the first time in my life. And when he picked me up at the airport in New York, he told me that I was doing like 80% of his turnover, and it just wasn't enough to sustain his factory. That's when I decided that I absolutely need to have at least one share of every company I deal with, so I know a little bit about their numbers, and that wouldn't happen to me again. And that eventually was the reason I bought shares from the next few companies I was dealing with. And that was AltaVista and Netscape and Intershop and NetScreen. And they all later on became billion-dollar companies. And that's what later on, you know, made an investor out of me. But in the beginning, I really only bought the shares to get the end year result and to know who I'm dealing with.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. How, you know, being a very young person then and saying, hey, you know, I want to be your distributor for these quite, which as well, especially later on became huge brands. How did you persuade them that you could actually be the distributor for Switzerland, that they should pick you?
Well, that was pretty easy. I read an article about Netscape in the newspaper, and their specialty was that they were running on Mac, on Windows, and on Linux platforms, our Unix platforms. And I already had another product from Sweden that was also running on those platforms. So I just, you know, cut the article out and send it to them. I asked my assistant to write a letter and saying, hey, we would like to be your distributor in Switzerland. And they said, well, sure, Sweden, Switzerland, Europe, we don't care. Just take the product, sell it, we're happy. I mean, Netscape was less than 100 people at the time, and they didn't look outside of the US at all. So that was pretty easy at that point to become a distributor for that.
I think as well, you were a distributor for Apple products. Do I remember that one correctly?
No.
No, that one not. How did you pick then these different distribution agreements beyond that? Like reading something in a newspaper, I guess there's this big wave, especially the first wave in the internet. How did you pick which companies to focus on, which distribution and
Good question. Yeah, I went to two, every year I went to two shows. One was in Hanover, the CeBIT, and one the Comdex from Edelson, who just died, I think last night or 2 days ago in Las Vegas. So every year I would go to these two shows and I would prepare myself thoroughly with ideas what could be a good field of distribution for me. And I would go through all the booths, and that's quite big. Hanover has, I think, 23 halls. Some of them have two or three floors. But I would go through every hall and look at every booth, and I would walk through quite fast, spend a few days, and I would look at every booth. And if I could not understand what they do while walking by, I would not be interested anyway, because I want to have easy to understand products. And that's how I chose the products to distribute.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. And then what was your pitch then after? What was it once you had the first distribution agreement that you always could say, hey, I'm established, I know what I'm doing in this space, I can push the volume up the quickest?
Well, in the beginning, it really was here you have somebody that is totally dedicated, that will cover Switzerland, a very difficult region where you need to have your manuals in three different languages, and you can't just sell an English product, and we will do the support, and we have support people that can understand Windows, DOS, Unix. And that was kind of my USP, that I was technically and marketing wise adept to handle Switzerland in the beginning, and then later we had other countries as well.
Mm-hmm. And what was the trick as well? I imagine putting these new products, these very innovative products in the market, is not an easy task to do. What were like a few lessons learned maybe across these different products, these different services that you were providing for other entrepreneurs that are thinking about starting their own companies? What should they focus on as they bring new products into the market?
So I think one key learning for me was that PR really works well and is cheap. So especially when you have new products and something that is different from what already exists in the market, you can really work with PR. And if you have a good relationship to the newspapers, and especially also the specialized newspapers, then they will listen to you and they'll be happy to write a story about a new product coming out on the market. Secondly, you can do marketing, and that will help you as well, but don't do the full page color ads, just do the, you know, very small black and white ads to save money. Because at the end of the day, it's not only the ad that you place, it's also the relationship that you manage with the newspapers. And in the combination of those two things, plus being available for your customers and for your employees and for your and also for the journalists, will be a big help. And I think the combination of that and being really on top of things all the time helped me to get going. And then I also had an unfair advantage. I have to say that I was the Netscape distributor, and that started the whole internet craziness. And because I was the Netscape distributor, afterwards all the other guys would automatically call me up. I mean, they pretty much anybody that came out with some internet product would look up in the phone book who's the Netscape distributor and can't we, you know, work with him. So I would get a lot of offers to distribute products, actually even more than I could handle.
Fantastic. And I assume as well, then you did a really great job, that Marc Andreessen is it, and so said like they want to keep working with you, and because Netscape became then the de facto standard, the entry door to the internet basically.
Yeah, I mean, I had the license to print money, because people were downloading Netscape for free from the internet and they could use it. And in the small print, it said, if you use it commercially, then you have to pay $17.90 per browser. So Swiss people, being very compliant, would call me up and say, hey, I've been using this product for 2 months and now I want to be compliant. Can you send me a bill? So I would just send out bills. And it was really, I could kind of print money. But what I always say is that, and that I think is really important to notice the difference between somebody who is lucky and somebody who is a businessman, is that you can cope with what happened afterwards. And what happened was that one day, Marc Andreessen's people called me and said, from tomorrow on, the product is for free. So from one day to the next, I had zero turnover with Netscape, which was very hard. I mean, 2 weeks before, I sold licenses for a few million dollars, and then had a big organization already with quite a few employees. And then the next day, the product is for free, because if you remember, Internet Explorer was for free and Microsoft really wanted to gain market share and put Internet Explorer for free on all the PCs and on everybody's machine. So there was no more business to be made. And of course, I didn't see it coming, but I kind of knew I can't have just one supplier and live only of this one supplier. So In parallel, I had Alta Vista, I had Intershop, I had Oracle, I had a lot of other companies where I was doing business, and I was able to survive this shock that otherwise would have killed my company.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. So a great lesson learned there as well, in terms of customers, or if you're not selling product from one supplier, to really diversify as well and watch out for this as an entrepreneur. Then what was your decision to say, okay, I quit this job as an entrepreneur to grow the sales distribution organization and switch sides of the table?
So what happened was that my company was acquired. Somebody really wanted me as their CEO, and they were happy to pay me an unreasonable price for selling the company to them. There was also a distributor called Telandus that was already on the stock market in Belgium, in the top 10 of the Belgian companies. And I had planned also to go public in November of 2000. And in the beginning of 2000, they approached me. They really, really wanted to buy my company. And I said, hey, I'm not selling, but if you're crazy enough to put this amount on the table, then I would consider. And they did. They put the money on the table and we did a very fast deal. I had a contract to do 3 years, to be the CEO of that company for 3 years. And that's why I sold. And then after my time was up with that company, I was left with the shares of the startups that I invested in earlier. And I decided that, looking at those, I mean, I was really lucky. The three first investments I did in startups, all three of them became not only unicorns, they became actually decacorns. So 10 billion and up. And you have to remember that was in the year 2000. So that was a long time ago where that was really money and there wasn't that many unicorns around. So looking at that, I said to myself, well, that's actually a pretty good business model as well. And that's how I became a venture capitalist.
Uh-huh. And how did you then start the investment part from there on? How did you look for companies and so? Is it the classical building deal flow up through relationships? Did you have a special focus?
So what happened is, so I did two, almost 3 years of vacation after I sold my company. And what happened, I was approached by Alain Nicot from Venture Incubator take on Venture Incubator with a team of three. And Venture Incubator is a fund, a 100 million Swiss francs fund that has 10 investors, Credit Suisse and Novartis and Nestle and ZKB, ABB, Hilti Schindler. So very prominent names from the Swiss industry. And I said, yes, I'm happy to do that, but only 50% of my time, 50% I do my own investments globally, whereas Venture Incubator was only investing in Swiss companies. Mm-hmm. So by doing that, and there was a lot of press around it when we started that, a well-known fund in Switzerland. So I automatically got a Swiss deal flow. And I already had a deal flow from being at CBIT and Comdex all the time, and from C-level people at Netscape and Intershop and Oracle that would start their own companies. So they would also come back to me for investments. So that's a little bit how it started.
Mm-hmm. I assume as well on many exciting areas, many investments to do. Any advice for people that look maybe at that are looking at different opportunities? What for you was the triggering moment to say, no, let's go for this one or the later ones as well? I think super fascinating, for example, how you invested in Facebook, how that came about.
Yeah, so, I mean, I always look at the unfair advantage. I always look for something that is so much better or has such a bigger potential or it's so much more efficient than what's on the market yet. So that's product-wise. And then I also look for persons that I think are winner types and will be able to execute and have the drive to win the battle out in the field against the competitors. I guess the trick to success is really walk through life and look at, and every time you see a problem, see if there is another really much more efficient way to solve the problem. And if somebody has that, then maybe try to invest in it.
Mm-hmm. How much more efficient or better should this be? Like, is it, are you thinking of the classical like 10x better? Like massively better? Any guidelines there to
yeah, I think 10x is, well, it depends what it is, how big the market is, but usually it's a lot more than 10x, so you don't really have to calculate. I always say if it works, there's no question about it, and I never have to take my calculator to see if I have better margins or not. The risk that I'm taking is that it will never work.
Mm-hmm.
So when I invested in Mobileye, the trick was we have one camera, and with one camera we can see the street, and we can see the distance to the next car, and we can see the distance to a wall or a curve, and we can do that real time. And everybody else said we need a laser or a radar or two cameras to, you know, judge the distance. And all of this is so much more complicated because you have to have software that takes in the input from the radar or the LiDAR or the camera or the cameras and calculate and triangulate and then do the whole thing, which makes it much more complicated and much more costly. If you can do it with just one camera, and then, you know, you don't have to calculate. You're going to be the world leader. And that's exactly what happened. We became the world leader. The only trouble was that for the first 6 years of the existence of the company, there wasn't a chip in the whole world that was fast enough to do it. And I mean, for the first 6 years, we thought next year there will be a chip and next year there will be a chip. But it took much, much longer. And we could have gone bankrupt 4 times. And it could have taken, instead of 6 years, it could have taken 16 years, who knows? And then we would have gone belly up. So the way to the, the risk is that we can never do it. And that risk I'm willing to take. But I always want to invest in something that if we can do it, then we're the only ones. And then we're the ones that win the market and that will, make big money.
Are you thinking then as well about odds, like kind of, let's say it needs to be a 50-50 chance or like at least a third or so, or can it be even like, hey, if it's 1 in 10, I'm still willing to do it?
Well, I need to be convinced that technically it is possible, and I'm an engineer, that's a big help, so I have an idea of what is technically or physically possible, and then I need to be convinced that I have a captain of the ship that is having the strength, the stamina, the vision, and the endurance to really get it through the finishing line.
Mm-hmm. Talking as well about the timing then of it, is there any way where you say, hey, this is too far from the market? Because oftentimes really these breakthrough developments, earlier we talked, last episode we talked with Lukasz Gadowski, for example, he's into the flying cars business now, Velocopter, and so how do you think about the timing, and if an entrepreneur should go for a special project regarding the timing and time to market?
Yeah. So timing is super, super important. And my sweet spot is 10 years. I want to invest in technologies that will be mainstream in 10 years. And the reason for that is if it's mainstream in 5 years, then there's probably already a lot of competitors that have seen it and that are already working on it. Then it's pretty obvious. So it's very difficult to make a good investment. And if it's 15 years, you're probably belly up and out of money because no investors likes to invest during 15 years without any turnover or income. So 10 years is really my sweet spot. And that's what I'm looking for. And sometimes it takes a bit longer. With Mobileye, it took 16 years until from first investment to IPO, and maybe 13 years from first investment to first turnover or profitability. And some other companies, it goes faster, like Facebook.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. What do these companies do then in the meantime? For many entrepreneurs struggle quite a bit, where they are not in this internet business, where they can do the immediate transaction and get a margin on that and then prove out traction. What for you in terms of milestones and so would be important in this span of these 10 years to really say, hey, with this progress, we can show traction, we can get additional financing, etc.?
Well, that is really very different from company to company. Especially if you compare life sciences and technology, there's such completely different milestones. It's very difficult to say. I mean, you have to know where your goal is, your vision is. You have to go towards that vision. You maybe have to do a pivot on the way, but you have to, you know, have some kind of tangible results every few months. If that's not happening, if I see, you know, it's not going anywhere and we're at the same point that we were a year ago, then obviously we have a problem.
Mm-hmm. So really engineer for progress and not just a year out or 2 years or 5 years out, but really almost every quarter or so, every half a year, there should be substantial progress and really focus as well on.
Yeah, I guess a good entrepreneur will be able to formulate baby steps to get to the end result. And those baby steps need to, you know, make sense and need to be measurable and need to be achieved in the time frame that he says he will achieve it, to give me a confidence to continue investing, because then I'll see if he can do the baby steps on time, he will be able to do the whole project as well.
Mm-hmm. Another part is you focus a lot on the entrepreneurs. Very important is that, like, the winning type. What are you looking for, especially?
So I'm looking for somebody that has, you know, stumbled over a problem and that, you know, does not let him sleep until he fixed that problem. Somebody that has a real mission in life and not somebody that goes out and says, okay, I want to become an entrepreneur. Let's see how I can make the most money with the easiest path. So one very good example is, I think, Mark Zuckerberg, who always said, I want to, you know, connect the whole world with each other, and who never really cared much about how much money he makes on the way to do that. But he had a very clear vision and a very clear path and a very clear idea of what he wants to achieve.
Mm-hmm. So really, as well, thinking big and thinking that that vision being pretty much a global vision for sure as well. Fascinating different discussion that we had, where you really thinking, oh, you as well, you told me, hey, this, it's just not big enough. I don't see the multi-billion dollar venture here. Aspect as well, what you say is important, really, like, especially for you, you say, hey, if we aren't starting something, it needs to be world changing.
Absolutely. So when I started to do investments, I didn't have that many, such a large possibility to choose from. So I would invest also in companies as long as it, you know, as long as I see there's an upside and I can make money, I would do it. But now I have such a large deal flow and such a global deal flow that for a few years already, I decided to do unicorns only, global only. I want to do things that really change the world, because on one hand, I think it's my mission to change the world to the better. It's more fun to be able to do something on a global level that really changes the lives of people. And at the end of the day, probably is also more profitable.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. Maybe a final thing to conclude, what are certain suggestions, advice you have for people that want to create these world-changing companies? Are there some common, let's say, mishappenings, or we say people that focus on these areas? So we talked about making the product, you know, the value delivered a 10x or even much more, 15x better. We talked about the team side of things. Overall, when you look at these different companies, especially these world-changing companies, where do you see people making a lot of mistakes as they try to build this organization out, this company out?
Mm-hmm. Very often I see, I mean, there's a few things. There's actually a whole list of things that I look for. Clearly, Harvard studies show that a team is has a better chance of succeeding than a person alone at the helm of a company. Clearly, a team of different people have more chances of success, meaning usually a technical and a business or marketing person together that are really different personalities. What I also see very often is people are not well informed. They don't know if they, you know, should do bootstrap or should go for venture capital money. I think it's really important that everybody is spending enough time on thinking about that. Very often people have not, you know, thought long enough about what exactly do they want to do, what is their USP, and that takes a very large amount of thinking to kind of write the vision or the, you know, profile of the company. And that's, you know, it should be a text that is maximum half a page long, just a few sentences, but those few sentences really make the difference. And that can really take very long time and can be very complicated, but is the most important part of what I look at. Actually, 3-4 sentences that explain to yourself, the world, your employees, your partners, what exactly it is you do and what exactly it is you do different than everybody else. And the development of those few sentences, I think most startups don't put enough time in it.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Maybe final concluding aspect of it. What for you personally do you enjoy the most, being involved in so many ventures? We learned how you brought many exciting companies to Switzerland. You invested in many unicorns. And so what for you personally, what's motivating you? What do you enjoy the most?
Well, I enjoy working with young people. I enjoy working with people who really are full of energy and want to change the world. And just yesterday, I had this brilliant example of somebody in really far out Brazil. He wrote me and sent me a picture of a SumUp terminal, where I'm the chairman of SumUp, which are credit card terminals. And he sent me a picture of the terminal in a little village in Brazil. And he says, there's no ATMs in this village at all, but we already have SumUp terminals out of Switzerland. So that really made me happy.
Daniel Gutenberg, thanks so much for taking the time and sharing these amazing insights. All the best going forward.
Thank you very much, and have a good day. And thank you for having me on your show.